Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here. G'day, Anila. How are you?
Hello. I'm tired.
And Tobiah, how are you?
Yeah, good.
It's actually very nice weather outside. There's a little bit of scurrying around because, of course, this is the 25th of April, and there are people making their way down to either Camp Sovereignty or to the shrine to wallow in the horror of war.
And don't let Annie mislead you. It's actually really chilly outside. Make sure to wear enough layers. I didn't do that this morning, and I think I almost froze to death.
13 degrees?
Yeah, but a cold 13.
A cold 13. You reckon too?
Cold? No, it's good. And plus, for Italians, today is the day of liberation, the 25th of April.
Oh, so how exciting.
Has different connotations this day to us. Yeah. And we'll be celebrating it at Democritus later. If people want to come, there'll be talks and stuff like that at 1 p.m. at 583 High Street.
Yeah, Northgate.
I've been watching a lot of AFL coverage of the Anzac Day round. And it's interesting, a lot of the associations with Anzac Day are about recognising quote-unquote heroism. So I think it's worth mentioning the point of Anzac Day isn't to glorify the valour of people who participate in war. It's to mourn the losses, the significant losses of the thousands of people that are killed unnecessarily and the towns that are destroyed, communities that are destroyed as a result. So I think pretty great day to be reflecting on all of the unnecessary losses of life going on far away from Australia. Did you want to do a bit of a weekly summary of what's been going on in Palestine and Lebanon?
Yeah, I can do a bit of a West Asia update here, courtesy of a collection of Dropsite News. We can say that this week a third US aircraft carrier has arrived in West Asia in a further build-up of naval power. U.S. Central Command said in a social media post that for the first time in decades, three aircraft carriers are operating in the Middle East at the same time. Accompanied by their carrier air wings, you have the U.S. Abraham Lincoln, the U.S. Gerald Ford, and the U.S. George H.W. Bush, including over 200 aircraft and 15,000 sailors and Marines. This is coupled with claims from Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz, who on Thursday says that Israeli forces are waiting for a green light from the United States to renew the war with Iran, saying Israel is ready. In a video conference, Israel Katz said that to complete the elimination of the Khomeini dynasty, he threatened to return Iran to the Dark Age and the Stone Age by destroying key energy and electricity facilities and dismantling its economic infrastructure.
Which is a crime against humanity, worth mentioning.
Yeah. Couple that with President Donald Trump warning that if on the same Thursday that if a deal is not reached, Iran's, quote, whole oil infrastructure is going to explode within days. He told reporters at the Oval Office he was in, quote, no rush for a deal and felt no pressure whatsoever, repeating his claim that the delays were due to the Iranian government being disorganized.
What a scumbag.
Yeah, he also said that he commented on the Strait of Hormuz, saying that Iran came to us and said, we'll agree to open the strait. He said, however, that he was the one who kept it closed, and it'll open when they want to make a deal or something else happened.
There's also, sorry to cut you off, Toby, but there's also a pretty interesting deadline coming up on May 1st. So as a result of the 1973 War Powers Act, Trump is obliged
in America.
Yep. Trump is obliged to limit the war after 60 days without congressional approval to continue the war. This would require him to be granted permission, essentially, from the House of Reps and the Senate. They must pass a joint resolution with a majority in each within the 60-day limit. It's also worth mentioning that in the meantime...
Do you think America is actually functioning as a democracy anymore?
I think not in practice for much longer than the last decade. I feel like their democracy has been pretty undemocratic for at least the last 30
years.
Well,
if you collect some of the feeds that are coming out of, I suppose middle-class versions of what America is, because it's a big place, they do talk about things like the outrage of a decade of increasing the veto power of the president. The president's role in the democracy has been made extremely authoritarian.
And lots of things like removing the strength of checks and balances in the judiciary and things like that.
Yeah,
so,
well,
there's been clearly
the whole process.
A massive breakdown in how, a democratic republic is supposed to function in theory.
It's sort of like the Bruce Willis version of, Die Hard version of running a country.
And I think worth, remembering there are real life consequences for them being this kind of inept, completely dysfunctional country. They're still the most powerful country in the world.
Well,
the UN has,
as you said, 60 days is the deadline.
But if the war does continue, regardless of whether the war continues, actually, the damage has been done pretty significantly. The UN reported this week that the current Iran war will push 30 million people back into poverty, with significant knock-on effects likely to affect food security.
Yeah, I mean, and all of this, what you guys are saying, I remember we reported on a, there's three American reports even, so from inside, that have conducted surveys with scholars and analyzed critical data that have said basically that the US is now no longer considered a liberal democracy and is now somewhere between on the low end of a democracy and a dictatorship. And it's something that we see of a trend, like, I mean, we talked to an Italian political scientist on Wednesday on Radio Philef, and he was saying the playbook is being written in places like Hungary and Italy, where they want a, he used a term like a dictatorcy or something like that, but it's like a somewhere between a democracy and a dictatorship, and something that was exemplified by Viktor Orban in Hungary, and something that Giorgia Meloni in Italy is readily pursuing.
Mind you, Hungary has just kicked him out.
Yeah, with now a more NATO Euro aligned,
yeah,
traditional sort of conservative figure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a kind of a left field sort of approach to headlines, but if we look at America, there was a fascinating report from Payday about Pittsburgh, which, of course, America is very big, but it gives you a sort of an idea of the melding, the meshing of Zionism, power, and misdirection in the news. I'll read what the Payday editor says. Greetings from the Berg, where the NFL draft has arrived here in Pittsburgh. More than 200,000 people are expected to arrive in the city for a three-day football festival. And I'm getting nervous as I see the police set up wooden horse barriers outside Payday's headquarters in the historic Hill District. Given the media attention on Pittsburgh, newly elected Pittsburgh Mayor Corey O'Connor has used the opportunity to meet with business and football leaders. This is Pittsburgh's moment, O'Connor posted on Facebook this morning as national media descended on the city. It also a huge moment for O'Connor, who remains politically unpopular with many progressives in the city, particularly in the African-American community. Last year, O'Connor narrowly defeated Black Pittsburgh Progressive Mayor Ed Gainey by 3,211 votes. O'Connor was accused of race baiting because he repeatedly claimed that crime had gone up under Gainey when it went down. Even Congresswoman Summer Lee called out O'Connor for engaging in dog whistle politics. O'Connor, whose mother is Jewish and grew up in the heavily Jewish neighbourhood of Squirrel Hill, where 11 Jews were killed in the largest Jewish massacre in American history in 2018, also repeatedly attacked Gainey over his opposition to the war in Israel. Despite his right-wing attacks on Gainey, O'Connor boasted in his campaign ads that he was a progressive. So it shocked many Democrats in the city that O'Connor posted a photograph yesterday boasting of securing the support of Robert Kraft, the billionaire owner of the New England Patriots and a major supporter of Donald Trump. So despite his right-wing attacks on Gainey, O'Connor boasted that he was a progressive. Hate has no home in Pittsburgh, wrote O'Connor on Facebook yesterday. Thank you, Robert Kraft, for your advocacy against anti-Semitism and inviting me to tonight's dinner. So you can see how it's all sort of enmeshing it's a really worrying sort of a trend. But there's also this business about AFGE, the largest union representing 300,000 employees at the Department of Defense, DOD, this is in US, expressed outrage after Defense Secretary appears to have issued a memo directing agencies and components to terminate all collective bargaining agreements between the DOD and the union. This action comes a year after President Trump signed Executive Order 14,251, which illegally stripped over 1 million federal employees of their union rights, citing national security reasons. Eep, 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 eep. It's really freaky.
I think as well, before we move on from everything that is freaky wrong with America. We also had the news this week from the Trump administration that they've decided to extend the Lebanon-Israel ceasefire, so-called ceasefire.
Because, make it so.
Yes, within the 10-day ceasefire, the non-permanent ceasefire, 3 people were killed by Israel. So, you know, whether or not it was a ceasefire is up for debate. But there were some interesting comments from political analyst Jason Ditz about the ceasefire being extended. He said that
President... When is a ceasefire not a ceasefire?
I don't know. When the Americans decide that they're not going to call it that anymore, I guess. President Trump's suggestion that his intention was to, quote, work with Lebanon to help them against Hezbollah once again suggests this ceasefire isn't actually intended to cease any fire. Hezbollah, who was not included in the talks and did not endorse the ceasefire, is going to continue to be targeted by a growing number of belligerent factions. Increasingly, however, targeting Hezbollah has meant targeting Lebanon's broader Shiite population, particularly in the south, where they've been broadly expelled from their homes, which are in the process of being destroyed by Israel on, quote, national security grounds. For the 20% of Lebanon's population presently displaced by the war, it is unlikely that this latest extension will change much.
Well, I'm going to bring us back to Australia, and there was a major announcement by Microsoft in its worldwide domination or using AI. It said that Microsoft yesterday, it was released a couple of days ago, announced the largest AI skilling commitment in Australia's history, a pledge to help 3 million Australians build workforce-ready AI skills by the end of 2028. Goes on to talk about how it's going to pledge digital skills across Australia and New Zealand, and the 2023 commitment to train 300,000 Australians, both achieved ahead of schedule, showing strong demand for practical learning. It's talking about rezoning a growing gap for young people across all parts of the workforce. We're partnering with Anyway, previously Year 13, to support the launch of the largest tool to support school leavers, an AI-powered career coach that delivers personalised career guidance to young people, built on Microsoft Azure. The tool enables schools and governments to scale personalised student guidance, reduce counsellor workloads, and deliver measurable improvements in youth outcomes and workforce readiness. Beyond classroom learning, Microsoft is also helping create cleaner pathways into the higher growth technical roles that will underpin Australia's AI economy. Microsoft's Data Centre Academy launched last year in Sydney with TAFE New South Wales and expanded in March to Melbourne in partnership with Victoria University, provides practical job-ready training and accessible entry points into data centre and cloud careers by connecting learners to in-depth, in-demand skills and industry-recognised experience. AI adoption can't be limited to specialists. As more organisations rapidly adopt AI, we're seeing the rise of the frontier worker, people in every function who combine domain expertise with AI literacy, sound judgment, and the ability to work effectively with AI tools and agents. It goes on to talk about Microsoft is working in partnership with Arcontis Academy to deliver AI learning modules designed specifically for field and deskless workers. The training is built around how field and trade-focused employees would use AI in practice. Microsoft's ongoing work with the Australian Council of Trade Union will ensure the workers' voice and skilling remain at the heart of the Australia's AI transformation, including through co-developing curriculum with the Australian Trade Unions Institute to equip union workers with the knowledge they need to support their members as they navigate AI transformation in the workplace. Now, the reason, and it goes on and on and on about how it's going to be completely enmeshed and fused with our educational system through government as well as our educational process. But at the same time, this is what has come out of Meta, which is the rebranding of Facebook. First wave to cut about 10% of Meta's workforce, sources tell Reuters. Further layoffs planned for later in 2026 remain not finalised. Meta opens new tab, intends to conduct a first wave of sweeping layoffs planned for this year on May 20, with more coming later, three sources familiar with the plans told Reuters. The Facebook and Instagram owner will lay off about 10% of its global workforce, or close to 8,000 employees, in that initial round, one of the sources said. The company is planning further layoffs in the second half of the year, the three sources said, although details of those cuts, including date and size, were not yet settled. Meta declined to comment on the timing or scope of planned cuts. It goes on to talk about things like Amazon.com opens new tab similarly as trimmed 30,000 corporate employees in recent months, representing nearly 10% of its white-collar workers, while in February the fintech company Blox opens new tab, chopped nearly half of its staff. The layoffs are connected to their use, their ongoing use of AI.
I think it's been...
So who are we supposed to believe here?
Well, I think we can believe some of the science that's already been produced around this stuff. We know that AI doesn't actually tend to increase productivity. We know that the big change that it tends to make is making these industries more profitable for shareholders and making workforces less stable and less secure. I think that's something that we do know, even at this early stage of the transition that we're seeing towards more AI integration. For Stick Together, I was having a chat with an organiser for the MUA, the Maritime Union of Australia, about a lot of these changes. And it's become very clear across lots of different industries, maritime industry, but also things like accounting, tertiary education sector, there's nowhere near enough regulation around how this is going to impact workers to keep up with how rapidly the government is investing in these AI economic opportunities. And even the Victorian Premier, the New South Wales Premier, they've been incredibly explicit about the fact that they're going to prioritise investment in AI over protections for the environment, for workers. They want to be easy investment sites.
Da-dun, da-dun. We're going to move on. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Tobiah and Anila, and we're going to go to the Hyde Park, 19th of April, Josh Lees. A Sydney rally for Palestine.
2.5 years now we've mobilised in our hundreds of thousands around this country to stop genocide, to stop endless war, to stop the endless atrocities and crimes carried out by the United States and by its proxy in the region, Israel, and by governments around the world like Australia, who have helped to back and arm these genocidal regimes day after day after day after day. No matter the war crimes they've committed, no matter the racist atrocities they've carried out, our government has continued every single day to keep the weapons and the weapons components flowing to that genocidal regime in Israel. And at the same time, of course, while allowing a genocide to occur, while actively materially supporting the genocide in Gaza and the wars carried out in the region, our government has acted to try to silence, repress and criminalise anti-genocide protesters in this country. And so that's why, of course, the case in which we had this big victory just a few days ago is such an important case. This is an important victory against the shocking undemocratic laws which Chris Minns rushed through New South Wales Parliament on Christmas Eve, his latest set of anti-protest laws based on complete and utter lies, of course based upon the obscene and ludicrous assertion that somehow the Bondi massacre had anything to do with this mass anti-war and anti-genocide movement. Of course, there's no evidence for this. Of course, it's a complete lie. And of course, Chris Minns has been trying to ban protests for years before the Bondi massacre. And we know his record of trying to exploit community fears and of trying to slander the Palestine movement as anti-Semitic and trying to ram through anti-protest laws on whatever fig leaf he can dream up. This, of course, is all bullshit. We've always made clear our complete opposition to all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. None of that has stopped Chris Minns, of course, trying to silence this movement. And we know why, because he's part of this war machine, he's part of a government, he's part of a system in this country which supports imperialist aggression and occupation on the other side of the world, because they see it as in the interest of the Australian state, the Australian ruling class here, to have allies like Israel and America in this world. And the more violent, the more bloodthirsty, the more racist, the better. That's how the Australian system views states like the US and Israel. Now, of course, in this case, we've had a big victory, and I want to salute, firstly, the other plaintiffs in this case, Lizzie Jarrett and Paul Silva from the Black Caucus, who put themselves front and centre to spearhead this case, along with myself from the Palestine Action Group, and, of course, Jews Against Occupation, Michelle Birkin, and all the other organisations who back this case, because this, of course, was not just an attack on the Palestine movement. This was an attack on the right to protest around any cause in this state. And this is how extreme these laws were that Chris Minns rushed through. These laws gave the police commissioner in this state the power to ban all protests around any issue, all street marches and even static rallies potentially around any cause whatsoever for up to 3 months in the entirety of New South Wales following a terrorist attack, which, by the way, could be a terrorist attack, could be a cyber terrorist attack, which took place anywhere in the world. Didn't even have to happen in Australia. So this is how extreme these anti-democratic laws were, which rightfully were struck down as unconstitutional. And this is, I think, the third time that Chris Minns has passed unconstitutional anti-protest laws. Now, we also, I want to salute as well, and crucially, everyone who defied those anti-protest laws, everyone who continued to rally, and especially everyone who turned out, the over 20 or 30,000 of us who turned out to take a stand against the PR tour of Isaac Herzog around this country on that fateful night, on Monday the 9th of February at Sydney Town Hall, when tens of thousands of us said, you cannot silence us, you will not silence us, we will protest against the genocide and we will protest against the president of a genocidal regime. When our leaders tour him here on a PR tour for genocide, we will stand up, we will stand with the people of Gaza and say, hell no, we will not be silenced. And even if we didn't know it at the time, I think we can look back and say now with some certainty that that was the protest which defeated these laws. It was that defiance on a mass scale which led to the victory in court we had three days ago. And that's not to take anything away from the absolutely brilliant legal team, who I also want to thank, as Mona's already said, our wonderful barristers, including Felicity Graham, such a champion for civil liberties and rights in this state. And of course, Nick Hanna, Roller, and everyone else from Hanna Legal and the other barristers and so on as well. We absolutely could not have done any of this at all without them. They worked very long and hard on this case. Now, of course, these shocking laws were used to unleash outrageous scenes of police brutality on the 9th of February. We know the stories, we know the dozens who were hospitalised, the dozens bashed by police, the hundreds pepper sprayed by police, and of course the thousands who had our basic democratic right to protest and to march stripped away by laws which we said and which are now confirmed to have been unconstitutional and invalid. That is the shocking thing that occurred on that night. There are tens of thousands of people who had their rights denied through unconstitutional police powers. And of course, we've seen that the police are still making arrests from that night. It's despicable. Despicable actions by New South Wales Police. There's been something like 40 arrests made in total now. They arrested 27 people on the night. Of course, they had to drop most of the charges because even by their bullshit standards, they knew that couldn't hold up in court. But they're subsequently making dozens more arrests, including, of course, crazy scenes of dawn raids, police, special police teams kicking in the doors of peaceful protesters. Now, the police are doing that and still trying to round people up, mainly, I think, because they're trying to create a political narrative of violent protests, which, of course, is a lie, to justify their own violence, to justify the police brutality that they meted out, and because they know there is this Law Enforcement Conduct Commission investigation taking place, which is going to come down with absolutely damning findings, I'm sure, about the actions of the police on that night. And of course, while we do condemn the actions of the police and their brutality on the night, we don't just blame the rank and file cops, we blame the chain of command. We blame the police commissioner, Mel Lanyon, we blame the police minister, Yasmin Catley, and we blame, of course, first and foremost, Chris Minns, who created that scenario, who effectively, if not directly, gave the order to police to violently attack peaceful protesters on that night. And that's why we say Chris Minns must resign. This guy is a threat to all of our democratic rights in this state, and he needs to go. He needs to resign. Of course, if he doesn't resign, he should be sacked. But the problem there, of course, is we look at who should do the sacking, and we know, because they've said it themselves in Senate estimates, that every single minister, every single cabinet member in Minns' government backed those laws. Backed the laws which we all knew were unconstitutional and were going to be struck down. That is a sign of how absolutely rotten this Labor Party is, our federal and state. Now, there's a number of important ramifications, of course, for this victory. The first, and one of the most important, is that we demand that all the charges against those people arrested on the night of the Herzog protest and since then must be dropped. They absolutely must be dropped immediately because they were based on unconstitutional laws, invalid police powers. They must be chucked in the bin immediately. The other thing, of course, that the police are trying to still hang their brutality on is the other set of outrageous laws which Chris Minns invoked to justify their police brutality, which was this invocation of a major event act. You know, this obscure piece of legislation which was designed for sporting events and so on, which then Chris Minns tried to enact for this political tour by a genocide-inciting Israeli president to tour the country. Now, of course, we tried to challenge that in court. Chris Minns only announced his invocation of those legal powers 2 days before the protest, so we didn't have time to challenge it on constitutional grounds. And one of the things about the victory we've had on Thursday is that I think it paves the way even more strongly for that decision to be thrown in the bin and for that those laws to also be overturned. The importance of that is that it will even more add to the need for all those charges to be dropped. It should also open the way even more clearly for hopefully massive civil claims against the police. Because people on that night, and we know, again, we know the stories, were assaulted by police, were bashed, were wrongfully arrested by police, were hospitalised, and everyone at that protest had our democratic rights denied by the actions of the police acting unconstitutionally. We also know this decision is a blow, of course, to all the other attempts they've got still in their back pocket to try to repress and criminalise the Palestine movement. Of course, Chris Minns, in this state, we know, wants to pass laws like Queensland to ban certain phrases. He wants to outlaw phrases like globalise the Intifada, a basic call for international solidarity against genocide. He wants to go down the road of Queensland. This victory, I think, is going to make them think twice, you would expect, about trying to bring those laws in now into New South Wales. And of course, the victory here strengthens everyone in Queensland who is fighting against those absolutely insane laws up there. Don't know if people saw the brilliant response from one of the people arrested for saying from the river to the sea. And he went before court and he said, "I would like to plead insanity because this charge is insane. And anyone who treats this charge with any seriousness is also insane." And that is the kind of response we need to this absolutely crazy situation where they're banning phrases while supporting a genocide. That's what we're seeing now. They're banning the lyrics to John Farnham songs. You know, some people may think singing John Farnham songs is a crime, but I don't. Certainly not for that reason. Now, and we've seen a growing resistance against these laws in Queensland, of course, yesterday, with hundreds of people protesting and many of them outrageously arrested. Okay, so this is a big legal victory for us, but of course legal victories only mean anything if they're part of an ongoing political struggle, and that's what we need to keep fighting for, of course. The genocide in Gaza continues. We all know that. We've all heard about that today again. The shocking war on Lebanon continues. The shocking slaughter of thousands of civilians in Lebanon, the displacement of millions of people to this day, the fact that thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Lebanese people have had their homes either destroyed or they are prevented from returning because of ongoing Israeli occupation and aggression and threats of further massacres, infrastructure destroyed. And of course, there are hundreds of thousands of people in this country directly affected by those crimes of Israel and America, not just in Gaza, but in Lebanon, and supported by our government. Our government is supporting these crimes against hundreds of thousands of people in this country, let alone around the world. And if we don't stop this endless war machine, and our government has just announced an extra $53 billion more to be spent on the Australian military, on top of all the other extra they've already added to that budget, on top of the hundreds of billions they're spending for this AUKUS deal with America and so on. This is what our leaders, our rulers have in store for the world, is a world of endless war and violence and racism and genocide. That is what our movement is all about stopping. Because as we've said all along, freeing Palestine means freeing the world. If we can stop the genocide and the war machine there, then it means we can stand up and stop the genocidal war machine, which the United States and Australia and everyone else is gearing up for, not just in the Middle East, but in future wars against China. Endless war, endless war, and endless war. That's what this system has in store for us. But people have the power to stop it. People have the power to rise up and stop it. We've done that through history, and that is the challenge for all of us in the coming years. Thank you. Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Chris Minns must resign!
Chris Minns
in the bed! Occupation is a crime! From Lebanon to Palestine!
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
My name is Windradyne, I am a Rajari. You may not know my face or my history. I was born on the plains before the white men come, with his cattle and his sheep, the horses and the gun. As a child I can recall song lines that we sang, hunt possum, kangaroo, with spear and boomerang. One day in the bush stood three ghostly men who said our land is theirs, and the trouble soon began. My name is Windradyne, they call me Saturday. Come Sunday I'll be gone, in the bush I melt away. I fought for my people on this country where I lay. My name is Windradyne, remember me that way. I see smoke of many fires in the morning light. Some are ours, some are theirs, left burning through the night. I know they tried to pin me for the trouble on King's Plain, but I threw a spear in self-defense of a musket in the rain. My name is Windradyne, they call me Saturday. Come Sunday I'll be gone, in the bush I melt away. I fought for my people on this country where I lay. My name is Windradyne, remember me that way. We came across a homestead lit by candlelight, thirsty for revenge from our camp attack last night. A white boy met us at the door, speaking native tongue. We left his house and headed off as quietly as we come. And just like every story, this one has an end, without all the glory bestowed on other men. They increased the reward to try and change my luck, but my people who fought with me, well, they never gave me up. My name is Windradyne, they call me Saturday. Come Sunday I'll be gone, in the bush I melt away. I fought for my people on this country where I lay. My name is Windradyne, remember me that way. My name is Windradyne, remember me that way.
Gallego Legend, And everyone, this is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yarra country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time. Where I belong.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Tobiah and Anila, and that song that we were listening to was contributed by Tobiah. It's Troy Cassadaly, and always good to... And it brought to mind a film that's just coming out, which is Wolfram. If you've got a chance, get along to see that, because it's really places. It's the second, I think, in a series of films about Australia and Aboriginal and white interaction at set just after the First World War, actually.
Well, it's important to say as well what Anila was saying about the original meaning for Anzac Day, or the original intention to mourn the dead, and that's why we played that song on Radio Philef this weekend. It's called Windradyne, because Troy Cassadaly read Mary Coe's biography of Windradyne, who was a Aboriginal resistance fighter, leader of a Wiradjuri nation, who led his people during to the Bathurst War, a frontier war with the British settlers. And I think today of all days is important to recognise those links of the Aboriginal resistance fighters that fought here, when we talk about resistance fighters in Palestine, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, etc. And that also here, there's a strong lineage of resistance fighters and a lot of people that died for their lands and for their people here.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to move to a speech that was given by Mercedes Zanka. Mercedes is part of the program on Friday night?
Friday Rave.
Yeah, Friday Rave. And she's...
A must listen.
A must listen. And she was speaking at an event on the 16th of April down at the Multicultural Hub. It was War versus Housing. She was talking about the increase in defence spending, which had happened just the night before, or the day before, at the press club. She's talking about how there's plenty of money, but are we getting anything for it? And how it also relates to the lack of care of public housing and other needs within society.
Today, Richard Marles announced at the press club the 2026 National Defence Strategy and Integrated Investment Program. I mean, it was an hour and a half to say sweet fuck all, really, but a big part of what that was is talking about an increase in private venture capital investing in defence projects. So that's increased the amount of spending. So what Richard Marles announced today was that through to the next decade, the defence budget is $425 billion, and he kind of boasted about that that over the next 4 years, an increase in additional $14 billion over the next 4 years. And I think one of the really cooked things that he was saying was that this is, you know, boasting about Labor's defence spending being the largest peacetime defence spending. And it's like, there's a war in Iran right now. Like, you know, Australia is absolutely complicit. There's been a genocide in Gaza for near on 3 years now, going on 77, you know. So what this means, I guess, with an increase in venture capital firms investing into defence and projects, is not only that they get returns, so there's, but also that we're going to see even less transparency. I mean, there's next to no transparency, but as these things become commercial in confidence and where that funding is actually coming from. So talking about even what the percentage of the GDP, the defence budget is, which at the moment is about 2.8%, Richard Marles' response was that the figures are all there. All you have to do is go through the FOIs that you're never going to get. You have to go through the budget. You can go through the integrated investment program. You can work it out all yourself. So they're actually not providing a figure of what it is of the GDP going forward, and that is on top of the Auditor General now having cancelled the major projects audit only a few weeks ago. So the one that we just got back in December is going to be the last major projects audit. on the privatisation. I think that this is, you know, a decades-long neoliberal policies, which when you're talking about defence and defence industrial base and manufacturing, which is happening in Australia, manufacturing is being bolstered by defence. Because neoliberal policies remove the capacity for government to fund and give grants for domestic manufacturing, and therefore there's got to be a national security exception for manufacturers. And I think this is really exemplified by the Ford factory in Geelong that closed down, is now the flagship Morand facility, which is the flagship of a group called the Australian Sovereign Defence Advanced Manufacturing Group. They're a conglomerate which are the largest exporter of their 35 parts in Australia of any other company or conglomerate. And so, again, when we see deals like this, they're all commercial in confidence, and I guess like coupled with the tightening of FOI restrictions and what is actually being able to be given. And I was just chatting with Nina before, who mentioned that in regards to the high-rise redevelopment program, the feasibility studies and 80% of the documents were withheld from the public around the feasibility of that. You know, one of the things that I think is really important to think about when we talk about defence budget and defence spending is that it's not just strictly limited to defence. Like, the Australian government has said itself that it's a whole of government approach. And so when we talk about a whole of government approach, this means education. They're just putting $15 million into increasing students coming into STEM programs in schools, specifically for the AUKUS program, to work on nuclear powered submarines that we're never going to get. Who wants them anyway? You know, another thing is the future made in Australia. And so this is this kind of like Australian government going, oh, look, we're bolstering manufacturing. It's a $23 billion program. And so $8 billion of that is for renewable hydrogen. It's come out in a report a couple of weeks ago. There are currently 5 renewable hydrogen projects, and for renewable energy, which seems like, you know, is not a bad thing. But for renewable hydrogen, there are currently about 5 projects that have been shelved because they're unfeasible, because the retooling of companies and facilities to actually be able to use hydrogen is not going to happen because there's no production. And so BHP, all the major multinational corporations, have shelved their projects in renewable hydrogen. But one of the, I guess, what you'd call sovereign companies that is pushing that is Fortescue Metals, Twiggy Forest. So the government are kind of just going to like fork out more money to Twiggy Forest. So I just want to speak to this in terms of like the whole of government approach of what future made in Australia, because this is $7 billion is being given to the critical minerals production tax credits. And so this is for companies like Lynas Rare Earths. I'm sure many of you know about the $8.5 billion critical minerals pipeline deal with the US and the Australian government that happened late last year with Trump. Prior to that announcement of this $8.5 billion pipeline to shore up critical mineral supply chains, the Albanese government really focused on that this was all for renewable energy, but renewable energy wasn't mentioned once in Albanese's announcement about this deal with Trump. It was all for defence. And we know that these, I think, AUKUS Virginia class sub needs about 12 tonnes of rare earth metals, which outputs about 2,800 tonnes of waste product, not including the actual environmental impact of digging it out of the ground. So the critical minerals production tax credits is $7 billion is just going forked out to private companies who are going to dig up the ground on stolen land for a pipeline to the US defence industrial base, which is now Australia is classed a domestic source in US policies. Sorry, I will talk just quickly on one project, because it kind of just seems like defence spending is just moving money around between mates, because I guess when you look at actual like material output of money going in, but the Boxer CRV, which is a combat reconnaissance vehicle, which Rheinmetall got the contract for in 2018, so 8 years ago. Rheinmetall is a German manufacturing company. The munitions for that are by Nioa, which are in Benalla, run by Bob Catter's son-in-law. Universal Motion Simulators, EOS, who I'm sure many of you have seen, Electro-Optical Systems, which have their weapons have been seen in Israel, and Rafael, which is Israel's third largest defence company. So in 2018, there was a $5.7 billion budget to deliver 211 Boxer combat reconnaissance vehicles. I think there was about 14 that have come from Germany. And just a couple of weeks ago, 8 years later, the first Boxer reconnaissance vehicle rolled off to the production line in Queensland that was still had German parts. So after 8 years, as of 2025, so as of the middle of last year, $3.14 billion of that project had already been spent for 20 vehicles. There's supposed to be 211 of them. So the remaining, what, $2.6 billion for another 190-odd vehicles, there's no timeline. They're saying there's no, the commercial in confidence, the deals with Nyawa and Rafael and EOS, which are the weapons and munitions systems, there's no timeline for when they're actually going to come. So I guess I just want to talk about this to go, like, it's a whole lot of bullshit and just pushing money around between people. It's actually just about keeping the flow of capital going rather than actually having a product under the guise of that we are perpetually at war and we're a target and we need to be strong in the Indo-Pacific and uphold the rules-based order. And I will just say the Boxer CRV in 2021, so initially Albert Systems had the contract for the battle management system, but it was found out that they had a backdoor to Israel, and so they got kicked off the program and then underwent a huge rejig to be able to be operating in Australia again. But those Boxer CRVs are going to be armed with Rafael Spike LR2 missile, which is the same missile that killed Zomi Frankum. So when we talk about a whole-of-government approach, and Albanese actually made the announcement apologising to Zomi Frankum's family from the floor of Rafael, Vali Rafael in Queensland. So I guess the main thing is just like when we're talking about a whole-of-government approach, it's like the decision of this government is to build a bigger fence or build a bigger table, and they're building a bigger fence. And when it comes to housing, it's like choosing to house people or choosing to arm the people that are beating them on the street. And that's exactly what they're doing. So when we're talking about the housing towers being demolished and the communities and the vulnerable communities that are going to be forcibly displaced from their homes and their communities, these are also people who have been forcibly displaced from where they're from because of Australia's military engagement overseas. And so they're being yet again forcibly displaced. And that's older people and vulnerable people. And I think it feels really weird to talk about defence spending and kind of like put it down to dollars and everything like that, because actually the real cost is like communities being torn apart, it's kids losing limbs, it's people dying, it's people losing their homes. Like that's what the real cost is. It's not just money. And there's no way to gauge what that is except listening to people themselves, but the government don't give a fuck. And they're going to keep doing it, so thank you.
The fuel crisis is putting growing pressure on our services and the people who rely on them. As prices for staples like oil and flour soar, donations are dropping, but the demand is rising. For thousands of refugee families with no government support, the Asylum Seeker Resource Center is the only safety net left. Please donate today at asrc.org.au. Together, we keep the safety net strong. The Asylum Seeker Resource Centre is a 3CR supporter.
Hi, I'm Ahmed from Fridway Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
A weak solidarity brekkie team listener, when $50 billion was the common big spend, big cut figure of the week. The Minister for Keeping People Healthy, brackets, if they can afford it, and ensuring people with disabilities can live with dignity, brackets, we can't afford it, Mark Cutler spending, was forced to cut the spending. Just when we thought the NDIS was about caring for people with disabilities, we discovered the NDIS is the disability. See, we simply can't afford to spend more than $50 billion on people who are a drain on the public purse. Big cuts required, but they've only got themselves to blame. The cuts wouldn't be necessary if they didn't abuse the system by using it. While the Minister for Being Offensive and Trained Killing, whose job is to be offensive and trained kill, Richard Moore's the bad guys, he of the giant mind, announced an increase in merchants of death spending of, yes, spot on, $53 billion. That's increase over and above the billions we already spend and over and above the $38 million a day for 30 years on submarines we'll never see, which doesn't really matter because even if they did turn up, technology would blow them out of the water or deeper under it before we could say waste of money. Therefore, the wise practitioners of the greatest little economic order of them all explain to we fiscal ignorance, well, this fiscal ignorant, I won't drag you in, listener, although if you're listening to this rubbish, you probably haven't got much idea. Wise practitioners explain how can we afford to support people who need support when we have far more pressing priorities like killing people and not taxing the filthy rich and the great fossil polluters, for instance, but we'll come to that. So, slash spending that benefits people, spend an extra $53 billion extra on killing and maiming, hopefully kill, because if they're maimed, well, we can't afford to help them. And of course, people with disabilities also only have themselves to blame that shysters and shonky fraudsters have taken advantage of the system thanks to the government's rigid oversight of the shysters and shonky fraudsters. But a major concession from Mark Cutler spending. The families receiving NDIS support are not responsible for shonks and rorters. Thanks for clearing that one up, Mark. Just when we thought people with disabilities and their families were all big-time crooks. Richard came up with an inspired thought to offset all that handout to the merchants of. The private sector, including super funds, could co-invest in the merchants of. He didn't explain how that worked, but his giant mind must know. Nonetheless, it doesn't matter. Hard as it is to believe, the private sector, including super funds, showed all the enthusiasm of a chook in a fox's lair. But, they declared patriotically, we are prepared to take your money. Doesn't it warm the cockles of to know the socialist thing to do is to invest workers' retirement funds into killing and slaughter and destruction, and know that merchants of merchandise flown off to Zion goes on killing and slaughtering and genociding and starving every day, just everywhere, surrounding Zion, Greater Zion, Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, you name it. They're all there defending liberty, freedom and democracy, their security. And it is their land, from the river to the sea, proven this week when the German Chancellor urged Zion not to engage in de facto annexation of the West Bank, prompting a righteous response from that delightful Zion finance minister, Smolrich. Appropriate, a finance minister with Rich in his name. Anyway, he retorted, you will not force us into ghettos in our own land. See, you can't annex your own land. While the rest of the world, or most of it, calls the West Bank occupied territory, and Zion generously refers to it as disputed territory, Smolrich's declaration leaves no doubt. Zion knows, and still faces danger. Why? Zion-trained killers, the most moral-trained killing machine in the world, Big Supremo Benjamin Netanyahu and his cohorts tell us, were forced to murder, or sorry, kill, two UNICEF contractors delivering water in Gaza this week, whom the UN of the US of the UN of the world said were two water contractors delivering water, but Zion knew were, yes, terrorists, who went close to the Zion-imposed yellow line, and we all know Gazans and water deliverers crossing the yellow line in Gaza, occupied disputed Gaza, are axiomatically terrorists. And anyway, ceasefire doesn't apply to Zion, else it would not be able to defend its security in all those places and countries where it defends its security, which are part of Zion from the river to the sea anyway. Worse, the new Hungarian government has joined other European governments in declaring it would arrest poor Benjamin if he set foot in on those war crime charges laid by the International Criminal Court. The world's a small place for Benjamin. Charges out in the big wide world, charges at home in his small but ever-expanding world. Mentioned a few weeks ago this very moral betting on war, the odd suggestion there could be just a touch of insider trading, so to speak. Well, this week, in the 5 minutes before Benjamin's puppet, US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump or the POR, made yet another reliable statement on their joint tactically brilliant invasion of evil Iran, totally contradicting his previous announcement some hours earlier, completely contradicting his previous etc., etc., some lucky punters made a killing based on the impact the statement would have on the price of oil. What luck! Just 5 minutes before, one case where the good oil proved spot on. Speaking of oil, well, well, fossils, the usual commie, greenie, wooden work in an iron lot, were telling a Greens-inspired Senate hearing, that says it all, doesn't it, buyers from the start, hearing that Trubler was he could raise billions by imposing a tax on the great gas behemoths and force them to pay for the product they extract from Trubler was he, totally disregarding the sensible response from the great behemoths saying, toss us the profits, Woodside with profits, Chevron et al., that taxing them would destroy investment in more and more gas, leading many of the long-haired greenie commie mob to display their true and anti-Trubler Aussie intent. Good, we need to abandon gas and take renewables seriously. The fallaciousness of that exposed by Western Trubler Aussie Supremo, Socialist Supremo, Roger Cook the Planet, who said taxing his state's biggest industry would be a disaster. Taxing the resources giants has superficial appeal, he said, but we need to attract more and more investment in gas, which will bring prosperity for decades, for which the industry needs a stable environment. And paying taxes is obviously not a stable environment. But we have to admire Roger. What dedication to the transition from gas to gas. Decades of, and we can be sure, Mother Earth must be celebrating the prospect of decades of prosperity if she lives to see it. And the Resources Minister, Madeleine King, hit the planet, summed it up even more succinctly. Okay, they get the gas for free, but they have to spend money to extract it. And we need more and more and more, displaying the socialist commitment to addressing climate change, if there is such a thing. Notice the Trubler Aussie Capitalist Review is co-sponsoring an event involving another most respected entity, the insurance industry, an insurance summit to discuss the issues the poor industry is encountering. Yes, what are they? We asked prominent executive Chuck Dodgy. Well, there are two particularly pressing matters, Chuck told us. Like, well, first, ensure rather than insure. Little in-house joke. Yes, hysterical. Yeah, thought you'd like it. Ensure the premiums keep rising way ahead of cost of living increases. And second, make sure the policy's small print guarantees is so watertight there's never the slightest risk we have to pay out any of them. That's it. It's a great start. As we celebrate the glories of train killing, of kill and be killed, class warfare continues apace. Sorry, I keep forgetting there's no such thing. One big, happy, caring employer, lazy, avaricious worker family. But I notice a power plant explosion in central India killed 9 workers and injured lots of others. A factory fire in southern India killed more than 20 workers, and another factory fire killed 8. Now, I raise this because if these industrial murders, or, sorry, accidents, had occurred in, say, Trubler Aussie or the US of, or His Most Gracious Majesty's home country, they would be wall-to-wall media coverage. But they didn't, and so they are lucky to make a few paragraphs tucked away at the bottom of the world news page. Unfortunately, back here, things are serious. The big Trubler Aussie, of whom we are all so proud, poor BHP for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, was forced to issue a, quote, stark warning that the caring business class relations landscape is driving the economy toward an investment cliff, not to mention the threats of taxing them. Evil unions moving into the decades-long de-unionised Pilbara, for instance. Win-win for caring employers and the lazy avaricious. And he quotes the same job, same pay nonsense, forcing bloody huge to fork out an extra $30,000 on each of its in-house labour hire workers. Billions a year. Billions falling off the investment cliff. Although, if union involvement will cost caring employers and if same job, same pay will cost billions, there must be a simple explanation we can't just put our finger on, other than that's what they have been ripping off those workers. Surely not. That would be win-lose. Finally, today we celebrate the glories of train killing, the events that honed our revered Trubler Aussie values. The very values caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo Angus Tailing knows the Islamic heathen hordes will not accept. The very hordes Trubler Aussie invaded to establish those values. great values like landing on the wrong beach in a military disaster, leading to the slaughter of working class cannon fodder, defending the 1788 invader. And a final warning, if we plan to watch the few footy matches we're still privileged to get on free-to-air telly, tune in at exactly the bounce the ball, well, throw up the ball time these times, throw up the ball, else with all the glory, glorified train-killing pre-game crap, we'll be throwing up all over the living room. Good morning.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM. The voice of the community.
And you are. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Anila and Tobias. And we're going to finish up the program with a piece that I clipped out of the outside broadcast that the gardening show did in March. It was just a great show, actually. They were at the flower show down the road in Carlton. And I have to say that 3CR did a great job doing the OB, and but this little section is actually about a collaboration. It's called the Wurundjeri and Botanical Gardens Garden, and the person that's involved in doing it talks about this collaborative effort to bring a deeper understanding of a native garden to our attention. And I thought it would be a worthy way of us communing with our natural world.
Listeners, you are tuned into the 3CR Gardening Show. We are live from the Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show at Carlton Gardens this morning. It's Chloe Foster and John Arnott here. We must welcome our next panellist to the show, Susanna Kennett-Lister, garden designer. You were on a couple of years ago. Susanna, again, you've been involved in the Royal Botanic Gardens and Wurundjeri Council collaboration garden. This is the third year that it's been
this
happening?
This is our third year, yes.
Yeah. Have you been involved in each year?
Since the beginning,
since
yes.
Since the beginning.
This is my fourth Mifkus and my third Indigenous garden. So I am deep in it.
You're a seasoned campaigner.
I am seasoned. Tell us about the garden this year.
Sure. So this year we have developed the idea around Bolan Bolan Billabong, which for those listening that may not know is a billabong in Baleen. It's actually the source of Baleen's name, Bolan Bolan.
Really? Oh,
it's a really
how lovely.
Yeah, it's a really significant place for Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people and many other clans of the Kulin Nation. It's been a gathering place for them for a very, very, very long time. It's an extremely resource-rich natural place. And when we were discussing what we might focus on this year, the idea of gathering places came up, and it felt like a really nice confluence given that the Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show brings more than 100,000 people, and that's a very big gathering.
The Fig in and of itself
the
is
fig,
a gathering.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, the site that we are at Mifkus in Carlton Gardens is a really significant place as well for the Aboriginal community.
Yeah.
It's been a place of gathering and protest for very, very, very long time.
Decades.
Well, especially from like the 1920s, but yeah. Even when the exhibition building was being built, there was a gathering to protest the building of that of the exhibition building on this site, because this has been a significant place for Aboriginal people too,
yeah,
for far longer than Europeans have been
so
here.
So there's a spirit of place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's a really, we thought that Bolan Bolan Billabong, which is an area that is kind of being quite heavily impacted by the construction of the Northeast Link, so it's a gathering place that's kind of worthy of our attention at this moment, and it's in a place of gathering for both the Aboriginal community in terms of its position near Gertrude Street and Mifkus, which is bringing all these people together.
So lots of layers of many layers of that place making.
Yeah, we're working hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you capture the essence of a Yarra Flats billabong on the scale of a show garden at Mifkus?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting challenge. Designing this garden, we are always balancing the kind of need to create something that feels of country and gentle and
authentic
and kind of drawing on all of the plants we use are indigenous plants to the area. This year we've kind of got a slightly simpler plant palette. Last year I think we had over 100 plant species in the garden, and this year we've kind of really pared it back. We've kind of gone for things that people will recognise, plant species that people can get quite easily.
Okay.
And in terms of replicating and kind of evoking the billabong in this space, obviously the use of water is really important, and using it in a way that's at ground level, something you can walk right up to. Which was a kind of technical challenge. The way that the garden is constructed is a little bit smoke and mirrors, but we've managed to kind of hide the way that we built that billabong so that people and visitors can walk right up to the edge of it.
Can we go behind the smoke and mirrors?
Yes, if you'd like to know.
Yeah.
So the construction of our garden is actually extremely simple, and it's the same method that we've used the last 3 years.
Okay.
So we're very fortunate to have Shapescaper supporting us. So their steel edging acts as the kind of boundary for our garden.
Okay.
And when it comes to creating the billabong, we use a higher profile of their steel edging, and we've simply rolled a pond liner over the top of that edging, and it creates just a very gentle shallow pool. We've created a bit more depth in that pool by putting a whole lot of eucalyptus leaves and mulch in there to get the tannins in, so we get that natural colour.
Very clever.
It's worked really well. We weren't sure it was going to work.
Yeah.
Because of, I mean, this is World Heritage listed garden. You can't dig into the ground?
No, we cannot break ground at all.
No.
We are allowed to put a few stakes in the ground to make the edging sit up,
yep.
But that's very, very low impact. And we have to be really careful given where we are situated under that really significant fig tree. Mm. So we don't do any construction works underneath the tree protection zone of that tree.
Yep.
So the only interventions we make is just putting a few stakes in the ground for the edging.
Wow.
Am I right to say that prior to the collaboration that we're talking about here, that there was no small First Nations footprint at Mifkis?
Very, very small. I think maybe in Mifkis's past there had been a couple of stands and things that focused on Indigenous planting, but nothing that had the representation and input of First Nations and traditional owners.
The co-design.
The co-design element, yeah. So the Wurundjeri elders and representatives that we work with, nobody had ever been involved with the show in that way before. So this is a really big shift.
It's pretty special.
It's awesome.
Good on you.
Long overdue.
Yeah,
for sure. The welcome to country ceremonies that have occurred in that garden, but probably for the 3 years that
each year we've had one.
They're really beautiful ceremonies.
Yeah, and we were super lucky. The last 2 years, we've been really lucky to have Uncle Bill Nicholson, who was also involved in the design of the garden this year.
Beautiful.
He's unfortunately wasn't able to be with us for the show, but he was really instrumental in sharing a bit of the knowledge around Bolan Bolan and Lyrebird, which also features in our garden.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other elders that have been part of the process have been through the garden in previous years, and this year coming through to see the way that it's been evolving. And this year we were all so thrilled to have Kathleen and Michaela and Charmaine from the Jiri Jiri Dancers come and open the show for us and welcome us to country, and it was sublime. It was really, really wonderful.
Little goosebumps just thinking about that. That's wonderful. So that co-design, what was the process of what did that look like?
Yeah, okay. So it's been developing now over 3 years, so we're really fortunate to have that ongoing relationship and trust. And generally the way the process works is that the first year the elders put forward the idea of having a garden that introduced people to the idea of Wurundjeri country and the scope of it.
Yep.
So we represented three different plant communities from across the breadth of Wurundjeri country.
Yep.
And then one of the things that came up as we were kind of debriefing about the success of the first garden, we thought, what did we miss? What did we not kind of draw out? And that year, the next thing became water country, which is super significant to Wurundjeri people. And then this year, there was that conversation about, okay, so what can we build on now? So we've talked about water country, we've talked about the scope, and the elders were kind of talking, the representatives were talking about what it feels like to be on country and the sensory elements of it and significant places within that water country, and that's how Bolan Bolan came up. So it is really just a conversation, ultimately, the co-design process, is that we get in the room, we start talking about the experiences that we've had, And then other things come up in conversation, stories, history, cultural, like plants that are significantly like embedded in cultural practice.
Yeah.
And then we think, okay, how can we represent that? And then the kind of landscape design team, which is myself, Andrew Laidlaw, Jacoby, who's one of the Aboriginal learning guides at the Botanic Gardens, really is nice. A huge part of the project this year as well.
Wonderful.
And also Harrison and Maria from Petrichor Collaborative, who came on board this year. So we would kind of all go away and we synthesize that feedback and those ideas, and then we put something on paper and we come back to the group and we say, what do you think about this? And they say, okay, that's great. What about, can we have a seating area here? And we just start throwing things back and forth, and then it kind of evolves.
Co-design.
Yeah. Co-design. It's really open and really, it flows really quickly and freely, which is beautiful.
How does your, outside of doing the show gardens here, how does all this sort of feed into your design practice?
It's a great question, and I actually spoke in the garden about the way that my design practice has evolved over the last couple of years and the way that it's influenced my thinking. And I think a really big part of it is I have learnt to decenter myself in the design process.
Put the ego aside.
I like to think I was never too egotistical about it all. But I kind of prioritize everything else around me and where I sit within that. And I try and do that for my clients as well, and learn how to balance the practical needs that you have in gardens and living within them, but do it in a way that lifts everything else up around you and kind of to your level. And I found that the thing that drives me is I look for gaps in my environment. Okay, I don't have enough small birds. I don't have, you know, the invertebrate levels aren't where I want them to be. What do I do? And I don't come to garden design so much from a purely aesthetic place anymore, which I think maybe I did as a younger designer.
Yeah, okay.
I'm now thinking about the kind of holistic systems that I can create. And the aesthetic stuff comes with it. I'm still me. I still have my preferences. I still have my kind of design drive.
Style.
I still have my style. But that is, like, the aesthetic expression is a product of my action in the garden.
Yeah.
Do you think Miscus get visitors becoming more open to displays having layers of ecology and layers of biodiversity and layers of culture?
I definitely
beyond
think so.
Beyond straight ornamentation?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, it's certainly... I mean, maybe it's because I'm embedded in my garden and I hear what people say when they come through
and
it.
And that's your jam.
And that's my jam. But I think absolutely people are really responding to that. And even if it's not kind of cerebral, you can see it when people walk into the garden and the way their bodies kind of relax and the fact that they sit down and they stay there. Like, I've kind of gone for walks and come back an hour later and the same people are still sitting in the garden.
Oh, that's nice.
And people through and say, oh, this is so energizing. And I think people, even if they don't think about it in, like, really literal terms, they're feeling it.
I mean, that's got to be the biggest endorsement that you could have with all of this hubbub and stuff to look at. People are stopping and dwelling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I've kind of felt, even for the last 3 years, that our little pocket up there under the fig tree is a place of respite, and it's a place that people really want to sit and engage with what we've put before them.
Mm.
And it's a really beautiful thing to see.
Mm.
I've really liked it. It's sort of a place that you know that there's that garden's going to be there now. Is there plans to continue this into the future?
There's certainly no plans to stop.
Good.
That was such a diplomatic answer.
Well played.
I think everybody, like the show, Wurundjeri Woiwurrung Aboriginal Heritage Corporation, the Botanic Gardens, everybody loves what's happening here and the way that the garden is developing. We had the program this year, which is the really, really exciting element, which is the first time we've managed to kind of activate the space in this way. And we're really kind of feeding off the energy of that. I can't promise I'll be involved.
What was the program?
The program, yeah. So I should mention it because we've got another day of programming left to go.
Yeah.
So a huge part of this year's gathering kind of theme and idea is that we wanted to bring people in and offer a direct kind of exchange of ideas and culture. So from Wednesday to Friday, we had Tully, who's one of the educators with Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, in running sessions on culture and plants and ecology and history with people within the garden. There were early years sessions, and there were sessions open to everybody. And then we've also had chats about design of the garden and storytelling And today, I think David Wong, who makes our beautiful sculpture, bird sculptures, is going to be speaking.
I was going to ask about those.
Yeah.
That seems to be a little bit of a signature of the...
It has become. Yeah, it's a
and
David.
They're umbrellas?
Yes, they're recycled umbrellas and also natural materials worked in. So David first designed the umbrella wa, which is the Wurundjeri word for crow, who are the protector of Wurundjeri country and people.
Yep.
He first designed those in our first garden in 2024 and the elders just loved them.
How like, nice.
They have so much personality and it was such a draw card for people coming through the show as well. So when we said, okay, we're going to do another garden, the elders were like, will the wa be there? and so David's also kind of been making a different bird. So last year we had white-faced herons and this year we have bulan bulan, which is the lyrebird.
Mm. And eels.
And eels, of course. I shouldn't forget our short-finned eels, or eelk is the Wurundjeri word for short-finned eel. Those guys are made of pool noodles. And they've got a special sleeve to get them the right colour. And little flywire fins.
Beyond the smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, absolutely. You've heard it all here.
Yeah. It's about indigenous culture, it's about people, but it's, you know, about indigenous plants. Sourcing that material, was that a challenge?
Yeah, so we're very lucky to have Jack Dewhurst, who's a horticulturalist with the Royal Botanic Gardens. He's been involved in the garden all 3 years.
Okay.
He looks after their Long Island collection. He has done the bulk of the plant sourcing for the past few years. This year, I think a huge relief for him was that we managed to get most of our plant material from just two or three nurseries. I think last year we pulled from about 10.
Yeah.
It's a huge job. Mm. And we're really lucky to have nurseries come on board. Regen nurseries have been huge, Australian ecosystems. And
for a lot of the grasses and the tufts.
For the grasses, stuff, yeah, some of the smaller and the tube stock, but also some gardenia, lamandras. What else have we got in there? The trees come from tall trees this year. We've had different tree suppliers in the past. These ones are a really good size. They're easy to kind of take the labour out of it a little bit. We can move them around. What else have we got? Regen, yeah, I mentioned Knoxbrook Nursery and the Narrup Rangers have supplied some of the special stuff like the chocolate lilies.
And you mentioned Wonderful. Petrichor.
Yes.
Which is the smell of rain.
It is. So Petrichor Collaborative are a group of architects, landscape architects and researchers. So Harris and Maria and Jacoby have been the members most involved with the garden this year. And they've brought a really wonderful element of... that really kind of grounded research and kind of blending that in with the design of the garden. And they ran a really beautiful workshop yesterday, which was about kind of envisaging the space as it was and potentially as it will be.
How lovely.
Yeah.
For Radiothon, Chloe found a button that was applause.
Yeah.
we actually needed to just
we
press,
need the buttons today.
Press the applause button. Because hats off.
Thank you so much.
To the collaboration.
Thank you.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks for coming in this morning.
We hope it continues. And we hope that that culture and country and indigenous flora is spread a little bit further.
Me too.
Throughout the show in the coming years.
It feels like it's embedding.
Absolutely.
Let's make it embedded.
Yeah.
We'll do our very best. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on to Bright and Early.
Pleasure.
That was Susanna Kennett-Lister, everyone involved in the Wurundjeri Council and Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria garden, show garden collaboration. This is the 3CR Gardening Show. We are live from the Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show at Carlton Gardens this morning. It's Chloe Foster, did I say my name? With John Arnott.
With John Arnott, yeah.
With John Arnott.
Yeah.
Botanica, a celebration of our natural environment, gardening and sustainability. Gather your Botanica-loving friends and family. The Botanica Festival, the National Trust of Australia, Victoria's annual celebration of the natural environment, sustainability and gardening is returning on Sunday the 10th of May, Mother's Day, at the iconic Ripponlea Estate. Held in partnership with City of Glenira Council and Milieu Property, Botanica brings together locals, young families and nature enthusiasts to one of Victoria's most majestic heritage listed sites for a lush celebration of nature, well-being and gardening. To find out more about Botanica, please visit ripponleaestate.com.au. a 3CR supporter.
And you're with Annie and Tobiah and Danila on Solidarity Breakfast. Hello, you guys.
Hello.
You really are here. It's not just me saying it. And
yeah,
that
we're
was
not one of those scary IS
simulacrums.
Oh my God! I heard a secretary. My friend had a booking for a mental health checkup, and there was an AI secretary that was coordinating the confirmation of the booking.
Oh.
Terrifying.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could go wrong? And that was, thank you very much to The Gardening Show for that little snippet from their wonderful outside broadcast in March at the Flower Show. I just found it really exciting to hear the cultural work that's going on to raise people's awareness of the country we're actually in. Tobiah, have got a big event on today.
Yeah, not just us. It was not just me, but it was organised by especially the younger members of PhilEF. I'll just read you from the stuff that they organised. Obviously, like I said at the top of the program, the 25th of April is Liberation Day, signifying the end of fascism
in Italy
after a long period of partisan resistance. And something that I saw while I was collecting photos for the slideshow that we'll have is that a lot of them are kind of really, I couldn't help but shake. One of the most impactful photos that I saw on post October 7th in Palestine was all these just Gazan civilians, all these Palestinian people just on a wrecked Israeli military vehicle celebrating. And this is a photo that I found in almost every city in Italy. Just to show like this continuity. And I mean, it's echoed all around the Mediterranean, this kind of feeling. But so today in honor of this and to reclaim something that has become somewhat of an institutionalized day in Italy and here, we're going to have a whole day of conversation, engagement, dance, music and celebration. So the doors are at one. We'll have some opening remarks by like some of the younger PhilEF crew that were instrumental in helping this. And then Dr. Joseph Toscano is going to be speaking about the history of Italian anti-fascism in Australia. And the history of actually, that's quite interesting, that was unknown to me, was how much Mussolini spent funding fascist cells in Queensland and stuff to disrupt and to condition the Italian diaspora from very early on. Also, he'll be speaking about civilian internment, which was the highest outside in the world around the World War One period was in Australia of Italian civilian internment here. Then we'll have presentation by PhilEF historians Lorella Di Pietro and Luca Esposito, who will be talking about, they'll be reading partisan letters and linking this to the history.
You have to wind it up.
Yeah, and then there'll be a movie screening, a tarantella workshop, and as well as music until
And food
until 11 p.m.
And so it's at Democritus?
583 High Street, Northcote, starting at 1 p.m. today.
And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We're going to go out with the ultimate Anzac song, The Pogues, Waltzing Matilda.
When I was a young man, I carried my pack and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda, as we sailed away from the quay. And amidst all the tears and the shouts and the cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, when the blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they call Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he primed himself well, he showered us with bullets and he rained us with shells, and in 5 minutes flat he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. And the band.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.